This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. What are you watching these days?
There was an offered before me. She helped me find my way out. She's dead. She's alive. She is me. We are handmaids.
I was a great wife. I was fun. I can't believe I'm losing him to Penny Pan. That's her name. Penny Pan. I'm sorry, but look at me. Who wouldn't want to come home to this every night?
Have you gotten sucked in by the marvelous Mrs. Maisel? I have. Waited excitedly for season 3 of Stranger Things and Handmaid's Tale. Guilty of binge-watching Ozark? Me too. They're all shows originating on streaming services like Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon. Do you even bother to watch cable or any of the big 3 networks? Today, Where We Live, we explore the changing media landscape. With all the choices out there, how do you decide what to watch? NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans will join us later with more on how streaming services are trying to set their shows apart. We'll also consider how access to streaming TV will change with the rollback of net neutrality. And if internet providers don't have to play by any rules set by the FCC, what does that mean for consumers who don't have the cash to pay for premium content? First, how much do you budget per month to subscribe to all of these services? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. I want to welcome our first guest to the show. She's joining us from NPR in New York City, Ashley Rodriguez. She covers media and marketing for Quartz. Ashley, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
So let's start with the news. We've all heard that Netflix is raising their price. Tell us, is this already in effect? And what has been the impact or response to the price hike?
Yes, for new subscribers, this is already in effect. So as of last week, if you went to go sign up for Netflix, you would see these new higher rates for each one of the packages that Netflix offers here in the U.S. For existing subscribers, they're going to be rolling out over the next couple of months. So you'll get an email in your inbox and you'll be notified through the app letting you know that this price hike is going to be coming to your account.
So a couple of bucks.
Yep. It's about $2 for the main account, right, which is the standard one. So it's jumping from $11.99 up to $13.99.
Meanwhile, Hulu's dropping their subscription price. Can you talk about why they're doing that?
Yeah, and this isn't the first time this has happened, right, where Netflix has raised prices in the U.S. and Hulu has dropped them around the same time. Hulu has tried this $6 per month promotion a couple of times before, and it's done pretty well for the company. So they're lowering their prices for their cheapest package down by a couple bucks each month. This is the package that comes with ads, right? They offer two services, one without ads, one with ads, and then they also have a more expensive live TV service. So this kind of lowers the bar for the cheapest offering that you can get into Hulu. And for folks who may be a little bit frustrated with the Netflix price hike, this might be a good opportunity for them to try something new out.
Well, when we think about those of us who are paying the lower price for Hulu and we're seeing the ads, does that mean we might be seeing more ads in the future, Ashley?
You know, that's a great question. If you think about Hulu's position right now, they're still a fairly young service. They have about 25 million subscribers here in the U.S. And so for them, it's really about growth, growth, growth by lowering the prices for this offering. And having advertising allows them to lower prices because they have another source of revenue that Netflix doesn't have for their content. So the question then becomes, once you've got a whole lot of people on this package, do you then start adding more ads in? Do you find a way to charge more for that advertising so you can make even more money off those consumers?
We played a few bits from popular shows right now, but when we think about Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and some of the other new players we're going to be hearing entering the market just in a couple of minutes, you know, what is, I guess, the magic number, Ashley, of how many subscriptions people are willing to pay for?
Well, it's interesting. There have been a lot of studies that have been around that have been done on this. Right now, people have access to roughly 4 video services, right? And that includes live TV. But they're willing to go up to about 6 services for streaming video. Research has from Magid, which is an entertainment research company, though, has found that they're not really to pay a whole lot more for that. The threshold is about $38 per month on average across your subscription video services like Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus, when that new service comes out later this year. So we're willing to accept new offerings, but we're really not willing to dig that much further into our wallets for them.
Joining us again from NPR Studios in New York is Ashley Rodriguez, who covers media and marketing for Quartz. As we talk about the rise of streaming services, do you often watch something based on Netflix programs or Hulu or Amazon? You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. When we think about Netflix increasing their price, are they hoping to maybe edge out some of those other competing services in terms of that magic $38 a month to subscribe to multiple services, Ashley?
Well, you can't ignore the timing. I mean, there are a lot of business reasons for Netflix to have raised their prices in the U.S. now, but growth is also slowing in this market. So it's an opportunity for them to also get more money from their customers, which they can then use to invest in content. If you look at the way that Netflix has been talking about themselves on their earnings calls for the last couple of quarters, it's really showing that, yeah, there may be a lot of streaming services out there and even more on the way, but they are the one that you have to have, right? They are the one when they say 80 million people or 80 million accounts have watched Bird Box. They're the one that you're going to have because all of your friends and family are going to be talking about that movie, that TV show at work and at school.
Again, this is Where We Live, and we're talking with Ashley Rodriguez. So you mentioned some of the new players, Disney being one of them. What are some other companies that are going to be coming on to try to take away possibly customers to Netflix and the Hulus?
WarnerMedia has a new offering that's expected to come out later this year, and this is going to be something that's going to bundle in a lot of the different WarnerMedia brands that are out there. So we've already got an HBO service. We could see them bringing in some of their other brands, maybe the DC characters, some of the Warner movies that they have out there. So they're going to put out a couple of packages later in the year. This is timed for around the fall or late 2019. And then next year, we're going to get an offering from NBC Universal. And that's going to be ad-supported, but it's also going to be pretty robust. There is going to be a version for people who have Comcast already, so Comcast owns NBC Universal, and there's going to be a version for subscribers who don't have that service. So these are two huge media companies, three if we're thinking about Disney, that are all coming into this space within the next year, really.
And with Disney Plus coming on board, what does that mean for if my child wants to see a Disney movie that's been carried, say, by Amazon or Netflix?
You know, I think that's going to be a must-have. Netflix's deal with Disney for new movies that were sent to stream on Netflix is going to be ending at the about September of this year, I believe. And so next year or later this year, we're going to see a lot of these movies start to move over to the Disney Plus service when that launches. Now, everything will not be on there at launch. So a lot of the older movies are still kind of tied up in many of these previous licensing deals. But over the years, you can expect to see, as those deals end, you can expect to see, you know, more of the Disney movie archive moving on to this Disney Plus service.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about the streaming services that seem to have overtaken traditional TV. Do you subscribe to Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, maybe looking forward to Disney Plus and other streaming services? Join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Joining our conversation now via Skype is Amanda Lotz, who's professor of digital media and communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia, also author of We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. Amanda, welcome to our show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So we've been hearing about some of the companies, coming forth, hoping to break in to the market that Netflix has dominated for so long. Can you talk about reasons for expansion? Do they see Netflix's model as not able to sustain itself in the long term?
No, I think it's more about trying to enhance their businesses. And so what Ashley has just laid out very well is really all of these different media companies that own an incredible amount of content looking for a way to go direct to consumer instead of having some sort of middleman in between the consumer and their business as content creators.
Oh, in terms of more niche providers, do they still have, some attraction to consumers who are seeing these bigger companies coming in?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons that it's attractive. I think a key one has to do with data and the ability to know a lot more about what people are watching, how they are watching it, in terms of the information that feeds back into the system of production.
Amanda, you mentioned that the companies are looking to expand their business model. Did they take too long to get to this point?
I think that's something that only time will tell. I think many of these companies actually were in the market almost a decade ago experimenting, and the consumer really just wasn't there yet. But Netflix is really deserves the credit for acculturating viewers to a new way of watching. And really the only way that the company was able to do that was with the kind of programming that Netflix was able to license from the existing studios that people were familiar with and that people wanted to watch. So I think it's a very natural progression for the industry.
So what are the challenges in front of them?
I think an enormous challenge is just the ability to figure out what amount of programming audiences want and to make all of the numbers work. I think the other piece that's really challenging is the backside. Netflix consumers, I'm one of them. I mean, we really take for granted how well all of it works. And that ability to have a good search mechanism of good recommendations, that the video that you choose plays more often than not and plays to completion, all of those are really big challenges that, because Netflix has taken such care in building its distribution infrastructure that gets the videos to our homes, we've taken that for granted, but I think that's actually much more difficult than many people recognize.
Ashley Rodriguez is also with us. She covers media and marketing for Quartz. When we think of Netflix, are they still considered the streaming king worldwide?
You know, I think they are. They've managed to hold on to that title, even with a lot of the new players that have come out, and platforms like Amazon Prime Video, which are really stepping up the content that they're putting out there and getting awards. We've seen Oscar nominations. They're starting to get recognition. So I think they're sort of the streaming king in television right now. And they're really just beginning to be the streaming king in movies. And I think they have a lot of runway in that department.
I had asked Amanda about if Netflix is sustainable. From your reporting, you talk often about how Netflix is running on a negative cash flow. They're putting in so much to find original content. But also, I'm just curious how they're going to be able to sustain themselves with this new competition coming online.
At the end of the day, it's an unproven business model, right? The idea of being able to offer premium content globally at such a low price point is really new. And even though Netflix has been doing this with streaming video for over 10 years now, they launched their streaming platform, it's still uncertain as they develop the business. Can they really complete this transformation from a tech company into a media company, and how will the economics work out in the long run? So I think that remains to be seen.
Amanda Lotz, who's joining us from Australia, professor of digital media and communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. What do you think about Netflix's ability to remain sustainable?
I agree with Ashley in terms of the uncertainty about this model. But I think the other piece that's really important is the international strategy and the way in which that really presents an opportunity that hasn't been tried before. And the fact that Netflix is really approaching it differently than media industries have in the past. In the past, U.S. Studios and producers have made content primarily for the U.S. market and then just sort of figured that they could push it out to different markets around the world. And Netflix has been much more savvy and has really started putting a lot of those, the programming dollars that often we talk about, so much money, well, but they're also putting that money not into just developing for the U.S. market, but creating original programming for those consumers around the globe. And that's really also another part of this grand video business experiment that's just uncharted territory.
Can we talk a little bit about Amazon? Because obviously Amazon Prime and streaming video is important for them, but they also tie it with the fact that they have Prime gives them, the consumer, so many other benefits like free two-day shipping, discounts at Whole Foods. And so is that something that consumers are more drawn to, Amanda?
I think we have to understand Amazon's business as something a little bit different. And Netflix really is a pure play. It's about creating video and people who want to watch that video. In the case of Amazon, the primary business there is still retail and driving more consumers into becoming Prime members because they know that when they have more Prime members, then those members spend more with Amazon as a retail business. And so I think, here too, we need to wait and see whether over the long term, video is really something that drives people to maintain a Prime membership or attracts them to Amazon in the first place. Does it add stickiness to an Amazon subscription and keeps people, paying that monthly or yearly fee for that Prime status? And so I do think that Amazon is measuring success differently than Netflix, and therefore we'd expect to see different strategies and we'd expect to see different programming as a result.
Ashley Rodriguez, who covers media and marketing for Quartz, we've been talking about Netflix investing in original content, but how much of a value is it for them to spend the money on sitcoms that have been really popular in the past, like The Office or Friends?
I think for those many people, they're staples, right? Everyone kind of has this resting program that they kind of go to in between watching newer stuff, and they just come to rely on that. But for Netflix, I also think it gets to be a little bit of a gateway into other Netflix content. So if you think about a show like The Office, which will probably be hugely expensive for them to renew, especially when NBC, which owns the show, has its own streaming service, and they may want to put it on that platform. For Netflix, the expense may still be worth it because they have a lot of other programming that ties into The Office, right? They just greenlit something called The Space Force, which is created by one of the co-creators of the U.S. version of The Office, Greg Daniels, and it's starring Steve Carell. They have lots of programming on there that has these stars from the show. So I think there will be certain types of programming like sitcoms such as The Office and Friends that will continue to be worth the investment, whereas some of the other aggregated stuff may come on and may leave the platform, may not be worth the big ticket that some of these media companies are going to be charging for it.
And Ashley, before we let you go, what will you be watching for in the next few months?
I'll definitely be interested to see how some of the big movies that Netflix is going to be putting out this year do for the company. They've gotten a lot of attention from critics lately, but this movie business is still really in the early days for them. So I'll be really curious to see how that develops.
Ashley Rodriguez, again, covers media and marketing for Quartz. We're going to tweet out links to some of her stories at Where We Live. Ashley, thanks for joining us today from NPR Studios in New York City.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Amanda Lotz will stay with us. She's professor of digital media and communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. Also author of We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. We're going to talk and learn more about how this has really impacted traditional TV. We're talking the big three networks and cable. And we're going to talk about how the end of net neutrality impacts the choices we have and the price we may be paying. You can join our conversation too, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Is your favorite show or shows carried on Netflix, Hulu, or Amazon? Are you one of the subscribers who cut the cord on cable a long time ago? The cost for cable alone makes the case to switch. It did for my household when we said goodbye to cable in late 2010 and opted to try out this funny-sounding Roku. To be completely honest, lifestyle changes also played a part. I knew I'd be stuck in an armchair with a newborn in frigid February temps and didn't want to be stuck watching soap operas or those awful game shows. Today we've been talking about the rise of internet streaming services. Now we wanted to know more about the impact on old-fashioned TV. Amanda Lotz joins us via Skype. She's professor of digital media and communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia, author of the book, We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. So, Amanda, how much of the rise in streaming services has impacted in terms of subscriptions or people having paying for cable?
I think it's really diversified the marketplace, and it's definitely given consumers far more options than they've had in the past. But at this point, we still see traditional linear television as the dominant way of receiving television in the U.S., although the percentage of television that is viewed that way has been steadily decreasing by among all audiences, except those over the age of 65.
Can we go back a little bit when we think about television and the big three networks and how cable seemed to change it all with the amount of content that people could choose from? So when we think about how streaming services is now growing, what are some of the things that streaming has learned from legacy TV, so to speak?
I think it's easy to forget that just 20 years ago, cable was a place that you went really just for old reruns or television shows that had previously aired on broadcast networks or old movies. So we're really not that far into a history of cable making their own programming. And it is from that fairly recent history that the streaming services took a lot of lessons. And one of the biggest ones there was the need to not try to create programming that was just like broadcast networks, but to bring something different to the table. And so the strategy, I think, through the first decade of the 21st century for a lot of cable channels was about creating distinctive programming that would stand out and really differentiate itself from what you might find on a broadcast network. And when the streaming services launched, let's say Netflix really getting into the market first with its originals, and that's very much what the service did with very buzzy announcements. The announcement about House of Cards went out a good 2 years before those episodes ever made it onto anyone's screen. And that was a huge announcement at the time in terms of the talent connected and the budgets that Netflix was willing to spend.
You mentioned that there's still millions who still are subscribing to cable and look forward to watching the network. So what is the content that they're looking for? Is it the local news and the sports?
I don't think so necessarily. I think that's definitely an important part of it. I think another part of it is that there still is a considerable amount of value in that cable package, especially for households with multiple members. If you're a household of one or maybe two, and your interests and tastes align, then indeed those streaming services can be pretty targeted. But in order to have kids and the content targeting them and maybe, two partners that have somewhat different tastes, the cable bundle still packs quite a bit of value. And the other part that comes with it is the way that cable service has really made the experience better by creating opportunities outside of that linear viewing. So that technologies such as video on demand or if you have a DVR, you can really replicate a lot of that experience of being able to watch what you want when you want that comes with the streaming service.
And now we're used to cable companies paying for cable, but also for our internet service.
Absolutely. I think that's a very important part of the story of the last decade is that the cable companies, they're not in trouble at all as a result of some people. And really, this notion of cord cutting isn't as widespread as many assume. All of those cable companies are now the internet service providers. And that is a business that actually has even better margins than they had as strictly video providers.
This is Where We Live. Again, today we're talking about the rise of streaming services and whether that has made a real impact on traditional TV as we know it. Amanda Lotz joining us via Skype. She's the author of We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. We want to hear from you, too. What are the services that you've come to rely on, and what are your concerns moving into the future as more and more companies come online? We just talked about how cable is bundled with Internet and what that means for the consumer. Join us at 860-275-7266. Joe's calling from Berlin. Joe, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Joe, go ahead.
Hi. So I have a couple of things that I think are really important when we're talking about net neutrality, and especially in the context of streaming video. You know, when this administration's FCC rolled back the net neutrality restrictions, it was portrayed as kind of getting out of the burden of regulation and creating competition. But I really think it's important when we're talking about video streaming. First off, this is 2019. The bandwidth is there. We can get the infrastructure to have video streaming in low cost. Hulu, we talk about a lot. Hulu is owned by NBC, Disney, AT&T through Warner Media, 21st Century Fox. It's all owned by traditional media. And, you know, I think there's this illusion, this smokescreen that there is competition, but really there's three players in the game. And I'm excited about all the new media that Hulu has, that Netflix has. But I think it's kind of a dog and pony show where the end goal is to keep us paying $100 for subpar internet and $30 for our streaming services. The infrastructure is there. I was reading an article yesterday. The infrastructure spending by big telecom and cable companies is down since the rollback of net neutrality. So there has not been innovation. There has not been, you know, spending on improving the infrastructure.
Joe, let me ask our guests to respond to some of the points that you've raised about all these companies and depending on who they're partnering with. And does that really mean competition for good service and content for the consumer? Amanda, can you weigh in before let's talk a little bit more about just a lot of these partnerships before we talk about net neutrality?
Sure. Now, I think Joe raises a really crucial question in asking where is the competition? And there we sort of have to tease apart the different businesses that are at play. Where there really isn't competition is in providing internet service and high-speed internet service at that. And that really is the crucial part for consumers in this new environment of needing competition at that level in order to appreciate, take advantage of these new services, and that also is where most of the cost is. And so when we had Ashley on earlier and we were talking about the price of Netflix, well, that assumes that you're already paying a monthly fee for internet, or you're watching Netflix over, let's say, a cellular data plan. So the big cost there in accessing programming that's distributed over the internet is in the internet cost and the fact that we really have very poor or no competition when it comes to those internet service providers.
Under the Obama administration, the net neutrality rules gave companies kind of the standard of what they had to play by, so to speak. But now that that's been rolled back, can we talk about the implications?
We can talk about them. I think they're not all that clear yet. And so I think the fact that there are both there's the threat of legislative action, and there are a number of judicial challenges that are coming from the states that are trying to reinstate those rules, mean that the last year doesn't tell us everything about what life without a net neutrality might be. I think a lot of those internet service providers, many of which are functionally monopoly internet service providers, are sitting back a bit and waiting to see what happens with those judicial and the potential for legislative action before really changing a lot of their policies. But I think the report that Joe notes about, you know, sort of this idea that if we got rid of net neutrality, that all of a sudden the internet service providers were going to put so much money into wiring places that don't already have high-speed internet, and that they were going to do all these things that were going to be beneficial for the consumers. We really haven't seen that happen at all.
When we talk about that this is unclear, when we think about the hypotheticals, it's been discussed that if people aren't willing to pay for a higher price, that they might not have as much high-speed internet as we've all come to be used to today. Is that really the primary concern, these different price points, and how companies could limit what types of content we're even accessing?
I think we're entering a new stage of media competition that we just haven't had before. And so, you know, a lot of it is pretty speculative. But this environment in which a company such as AT&T can also control content. So, you know, if you want to think about that, there are different businesses going on here. There's the business of actually providing the service into your house. And that's, let's say, what a company like AT&T does. And for the most part in the U.S., we've had different companies providing the service than have actually made the shows and then distributed the shows. And so an environment, let's say, in which AT&T owns HBO and can control how much you pay for HBO based on whether or not you are an AT&T subscriber, this is really a new set of competitive strategies that are coming into the marketplace. And I think it's just not clear exactly how far many of these companies will go in terms of using their ownership of content to also drive subscriber behavior. Because again, you know, where a ton of this money actually is in those monthly fees for internet service, much less so than, you know, what's out there in terms of a monthly Netflix subscription.
You can join our conversation today on Where We Live, 860-275-7266. Don's calling from Bloomfield. Don, go ahead.
Hi. I'm retired, and I'm not going to play the poor card, but the idea that there are going to be more and more services going after my subscriber money is sort of annoying. you know, we have Netflix. I don't expect to get more. There are already a number of services we don't subscribe to because we see ads for some of their shows, but we're just not going to spend more. And I sort of feel like I'm in a school of little fish surrounded by sharks, and more sharks are showing up all the time. So, and I used to work in cable, so.
Well, Don, thank you for that description. Amanda, did you want to respond to Don about how he feels about being the small consumer and with all these companies coming online?
Well, I think Don's point is well taken, and frankly, I think it's the position of most Americans, right? Just because there are all these new services coming to market means very little. We'll wait and see how quickly they are adopted. And I think the expectation that sort of like you will have in the way that when you have cable, you subscribe to cable, and pretty much the expectation is, you know, you're going to have cable as long as you live in that house, perhaps. That's really just not the way that these streaming services work. They're much easier to pick up and have for a few months and cancel. And I think the other piece of it that is valuable to a consumer such as Don is the choice that's available now. And so if you like NBC shows, let's say, you could have, depending on where you live, you may be able to receive them over the air through the actual broadcast signal. You might access them through a cable subscription, and that might be the most affordable way to get the range of programming that you desire. Or now you could also subscribe to Hulu and receive many of the programs that NBC offers in that way. And so I think what is potentially exciting or valuable about the current moment really is that it's not the case anymore that You know, 115 million U.S. households are really being pushed to all watch television in the same way. And what the companies are doing when Disney's launching portals and Warner is doing the same thing, what they're trying to do is make sure that their programming is available to people no matter how they want to access. They want to reach you if you're a cable subscriber, and they don't want to lose you if you don't want to be a cable subscriber. And so I think the conversation is often about who's going to win and who's going to lose, as though it's all or nothing. But I actually think that we're heading into an environment where there are a lot of different norms, and that it isn't the case that only Netflix can win, or that only internet distributed television can win, but actually that we have a marketplace of video distribution where there is more choice than there has been. I think the key question will continue to be at what cost, and really remembering the cost that comes with internet service provision in general.
Do you feel like consumers today are pretty savvy, picking and choosing? So there's all these different companies that they can subscribe to. But if the price is going up, or they're not happy with the content, or maybe waiting for some type of promotion, that consumers are really aren't to be led astray by these companies, that they've been able to make the choices that work for them.
I think it does require a lot more of consumers in terms of understanding what's out there. And it may require them to think a lot more about, what is really valuable to them, what is the most important part of their television or video experience, and to make those decisions accordingly. But it is difficult, I think, to stay abreast of all of the changes and to really have a sense of what service is going to be valuable to you in what way.
Before we let you go, Amanda, is it a generational thing? Do you feel like older Americans are more prone to stick with cable, and it's the millennial generation, so to speak, that are willing to try these different streaming services as they come on board?
Oh, you just left me and my Generation X out. we're always not part of that conversation. I think it's acculturation and change. It may seem to be showing up primarily in the younger demographics, but the data at this point is showing decreased watching of television with all groups under the age of 65. And so I think part of it has to do with willingness to try new products. But I think the other thing that we're seeing is that 10 years ago, there was this presumption that, quote unquote, digital natives were going to do everything differently. And you also have the issue of life stage and, sort of when does a cable package start to become really valuable? Well, it starts to become valuable when you have multiple bodies in your household that don't all want to watch the same thing. So I think the fact that actually cable numbers have not, fallen off the cliff as many expected suggests that traditional cable might be a product, especially in an environment that is priced the way it is and where internet service is really priced without a lot of competition, that continues to be valuable for certain kinds of households. And so I think, again, we're only going to continue to have new generations of consumers that are aware that there are a wide array of options and a wide array of ways of accessing the video that is desired.
Amanda Lotz, professor of digital media and communication at Queensland University of Technology in Australia. She joined us via Skype today, also author of the book We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. Amanda, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. There are so many shows we could be watching. With more competition from streaming services, how are they setting their programs apart? NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans joins us after the break with his take and recommendations of shows you gotta see. Join the conversation. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We're pleased to have Eric Deggans joining us by phone. He's TV critic for NPR. Eric, welcome to Where We Live.
Hey, how you doing?
So we were talking about all the competition, so to speak, out there with these new companies coming online, more streaming content for consumers. But when you think about the work that you're doing, reviewing and checking out a lot of the content out there, who's coming up with the most innovative stuff?
Wow, that's a big question. I think the question before us is yet to be answered, because there's all these streaming services that we haven't seen yet. So, you know, Apple has one that's supposedly coming. There's Disney Plus that we know is coming in the third quarter this year, I do believe. Warner Media, Warner Brothers is developing one. And Comcast just announced that they're doing one connected to NBC. Now, with Disney, we know that they're going to develop original content around the Star Wars franchise. Apple has been making a lot of high-profile deals with big-name talent like Reese Witherspoon. So it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. With what we have now, what we see, the strategy seems to be something that Netflix kind of pioneered, and in fact HBO pioneered before that, this idea that you spend a lot of money and you come up with a high-quality, successful TV show that epitomizes what your brand is as a streaming service. So Hulu managed that with The Handmaid's Tale. Netflix did that with both House of Cards and Orange is the New Black dropping in the same year within months of each other. We've seen this on Amazon with shows like Transparent and then later Homecoming. So the question before us now is, what signature big ticket drama or innovative TV show is Apple going to come up with? Is Disney Plus going to come up with? Is Warner Media going to come up with? And will it be enough to encourage consumers to spend that extra $7, $8, $10, $12, $15 to add that streaming service to a suite of streaming services they probably already pay for?
So in your view, when we think about high-quality content, is it coming from streaming services versus traditional TV?
Well, it seems that the high-quality space is moving to streaming and to premium cable channels like HBO and Showtime and Starz. They seem to be paying the money to get movie stars to come on to do their projects. These projects that feel more like long-form movies split into 8 or 10 episodes, 13 episodes, rather than, more conventional TV series. I think we saw this division really starkly this fall. You know, all the networks kick off their new programming in the fall, and it was all very conventional kind of stuff. Not even as innovative as recent shows like This Is Us or Black-ish or, you know, shows that pioneered in diversity or pioneered in storytelling style. They, you know, when the biggest news is that Tim Allen is moving a sitcom from ABC to Fox, you know, you got a problem. And but in the streaming space, you know, we've seen Julia Roberts do her first starring role in a TV show that's garnered lots of attention and awards in Homecoming. You know, Handmaid's Tale, of course, has blazed a lot of trails. We've seen shows like Insecure and on HBO kind of blaze a trail in terms of diversity. And now we hear that Issa Rae, the star of Insecure, is going to, develop a sketch show featuring African-American women, and that's going to be on HBO, I do believe. So, you know, those premium spaces and streaming services and a few sort of high-end standard cable channels like FX and AMC seem to be developing the lion's share of shows that are considered high quality. And then network TV seems to have accepted its lot as sort of the great middle. You know, it's offering shows that are decent enough, but they're often formulaic, and they're aimed at getting the biggest audience possible, as opposed to appealing to a specific audience with high quality, the way some of these
shows like True Detective or Insecure seem to do.
Eric Deggans is with us by phone, TV critic for NPR. So when we look at what we're used to seeing on Netflix or Amazon, Hulu, can you talk a little bit about how there's blending happening, maybe the quality between movies and TV and the fact that sometimes we can just watch it all at once if we want to?
Yeah, well, first of all, we're seeing the movie industry blend with the streaming industry, which we've decided to call television most of the time, except for when it's special projects like Roma, you know. So it's hard to know exactly what you're talking about in an odd way. Amazon Studios produces movies. You know, they did Manchester by the Sea. But they also produce a lot of television. Netflix produces projects that are considered movies, like Roma, that's, you know, contending for an Oscar. But it's available to watch on Netflix, which you watch on your television. And then we also have these projects like HBO's True Detective, where you know, you get a star who from you know, one of the hottest movies out there, Green Book, to star in, you know, an 8 or 10 episode series that's limited. It's like a larger story. It's like a larger movie told over multiple episodes, but it's just one season. He's just going to do that, and then when they do another season of True Detective, there'll be a different star in a different story. It's an anthology. So we have all these different forms operating in this space that have sort of blended together the world of film and television. And I think it's also because consumers are blending those worlds. You know, we're entering a world where people's home theater systems are pretty advanced. It's a pretty pleasurable experience to watch a film on a TV in your home if you've got a nice sound system and a big enough screen. And, you know, frankly, the theater-going experience can be expensive. It can be annoying. You know, other people sometimes don't know how to conduct themselves in movie theaters. So so there's a lot of reasons, I think, why we're seeing, you know, these two industries meld. We've also reached a point where the traditional Hollywood movie industry doesn't have room for the kind of mid-level films that it used to offer. And so those mid-level films are now becoming TV shows. So something like True Detective, I think, 10 or 15 years ago would have been a movie. You know, but the Hollywood studios are not invested in making those kind of films anymore. So streaming has stepped up, and they go to talented people and they say, "Look, you know, we're not going to force you to tell the story in 2 hours. We're going to give you, mm-hmm. you know, 8 or 10 episodes to tell it, and we'll give you the production so it looks really nice, and you'll have a star like Mahershala Ali, and you'll get the resources you need to really tell the story the way you want to." And sometimes that results in really wonderful products.
Eric, we just have a couple of minutes left. I have to ask you, as a TV critic, how has your job changed trying to keep abreast of all of these new shows coming out and the fact that they can all be dumped in one night?
Yeah, well, it is, you know, poor me. I get paid to watch television. But what ultimately happens is that you have to watch more television. Like, as I said, because these are, you know, movie-level plots that are stretched out over a wide number of episodes, I have to watch a lot more episodes of a show before I know whether or not it's any good. And there's also a lot more material out there. Now, what it also means, though, my ultimate job is trying to tell stories about television that tell us something about ourselves. And so it's a target-rich environment. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there, and there's a lot of revealing stuff out there. So, you know, I can do a story about Marie Kondo's new show on Netflix about getting rid about decluttering, and what does that say about us? And then I can turn around, and I can do a story about this great new drama, Black Earth Rising, about the aftermath of the genocide in Rwanda. And then I can turn around and I can talk about a great new talk show or series of talk shows on a bunch of different channels that are trying to reinvent the form. So there's a lot of great stories to be told out there. And as your previous guest noted, people need help sorting through all this stuff. So the the best thing I can do is watch all this stuff for people who don't have time to sample at all and just direct them towards the stuff that's most worth their time. And I think more and more often that's what I'm doing. I'm sort of helping people curate their media experience.
We'll tweet out a link to your review of Black Earth Rising, which you just mentioned. We've got under a minute to go. Can you give us a couple more names of shows that we should check out, Eric?
Okay. Well, I mentioned True Detective. I'm a big fan of Mahershala Ali, and I think they've done a great job sort of reinventing that show after a disastrous second season into something that's really interesting for the third season. There's this really interesting show that's going to come in March called Shrill that's on AMC. It's about an overweight woman who sort of discovers herself and decides to stop accepting the way that the world has marginalized her. It's a really great sort of dramedy that's coming on AMC that I think people would like to see. The best thing about, you know, today's times is that there's so much good content out there that you don't have to spend a lot of money to have access to a lot of cool stuff. I love the new Star Trek series on CBS All Access. You know, that's movie level magic on a TV.
And Eric, so, we're going to have to leave it there. I wish we had more time, but
sure.
We'll tweet out again with some links to your latest reviews. Eric Deggans, NPR TV critic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Thanks for listening.